Court appointed is meant to be for entertainment purposes and basic legal information only.
Nothing in this podcast should be considered as legal representation nor legal advice.
Only use the knowledge presented herein to dazzle your friends or possibly win bar trivia. Welcome to Court Appointed, Two Dudes' Perspective on Legal Frivolity. I'm your co-host, Mike Meadows. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurl. And I am just a dude.
Well, this episode of Court Appointed is going to be a little bit different.
Ho, 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 little Mikey bud.
Tommy had an idea for a different kind of show, so I'm going to let him explain it.
Well, we've had requests from time to time to do a podcast of just railroad stories. So
you mean an episode?
An episode, yes. Not a separate podcast. Wait, I never word that right, do I?
You do most of the time. Usually you correct me because I get it wrong.
Yeah, well, it's an episode on what we are a legal podcast, so we have to have that in. So we're going to regale you with railroad and lawyer stories for Christmas time, because I mean, after all, at Christmas we all tell stories and, you know, sweet things. And so that's what we're going to do is pass these stories along.
Can sit around the fireplace, drink eggnog, and listen to us spin some yarns.
Listen to old railroad stories and tales of lawyers, of things they have heard and said.
Tales of Law. That might be a good name for actually a new podcast.
Tales of Law?
Yeah.
I don't know. I'm not sure how that would work, although there is a lot of interesting stuff going on legal avenues these days that we will have to delve into in future episodes of this very podcast.
You flip it around and go, Law Tales.
Woohoo. Duck Tales. Huh? I knew where you were going with that.
I can't say that phrase without going, woohoo. All right. Well, you want to start off with some railroad stories?
Well, I might as well start at the beginning. How about that? That's a good place to start with a story.
Take us back.
Well, take you back to a young Tommy Smurl. Well,
you were born into the railroad family.
Well, that's true. I was a third generation railroader. My father was a railroader, and his father was a railroader, and actually my mother's grandfather was a railroader.
So you don't have veins. You have railroad tracks in your veins.
That's right.
For veins, or something like that.
I bleed coal dust or something like that.
I probably do too, just from all of it in the air.
But I got my start with the railroad right out of college, getting hired in a management training program. Now, if any of you ever been a management trainee in something like this, you are not often met very fondly by those above or below you. They really don't have any use for you because, like the railroad is a very militaristic thing. It's about as close to the military as you can get without being in the military. Most of the people that are the supervisors came up through the ranks. Mm-hmm. Probably 90-95% of the supervisors came up through the ranks. So they actually worked those jobs out there as trainmen and engineers and things like that before they were promoted up and into the managerial positions. So they look down on people that just get hired in right out of college. It's like, what does this whippersnapper know?
What do you know, college boy?
Yeah, you got the college degree. You figure it out. So
I went to the School of Hard Knocks.
And let me tell you, there is nothing they teach you in college that helps you on the railroad.
I'm sure.
Experience is the hard knocks is the only thing that teaches you anything on the railroad.
My class I took on how to drive railroad ties didn't prepare me for work on the railroad.
No, that didn't do it. So, and then the people that you supervise, they don't have any respect for you because you never did this job. How can you tell me what to do? You never did it.
Yeah.
So you get it from both sides. So it's a tough job being a trainee coming in on the railroad. Maybe that same way in other industries, I'm not sure. But it's not for the faint of heart. But as an example of this, well, the first thing I should say is I always wondered, the railroad was filled with characters. I mean, more characters than I've ever encountered anywhere. And I always wondered if the railroad attracted these kind of people or if it bred these kind of people, if they became that because of the railroad. I never knew, but there was tons of characters out there.
The classic nature nurture argument.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it was really bizarre. There were so many that you just tell stories and you tell them to other people, and they're like, "Oh, that didn't really happen. There never was really a guy like that, right?" Yes, there was, and they were plentiful on the railroad. One of the first ones I encountered was a division manager named L.O. Robinson. It was in Columbus, because as a trainee, we traveled around all the other divisions on the railroad to learn the entire railroad, not just one terminal or something. Mm-hmm. So we went up there, and this guy, he was one of these kind of old head railroaders that had no use for trainees. They weren't going to know anything, and he didn't care what they thought or anything else. So we went up there, and he sat us down in the conference room, and he started talking, and he said, "Yeah, you see, here's what I think about you guys. My kid, see, he's got one of these rock tumbler things, and you go down to the river, and you pick up a bunch of rocks down along the river, and you throw them in this rock tumbler, and you add some chemicals, and you just let the thing run for about a month. And at the end of that month, you reach in there and you pull them out, and some of those rocks have become beautiful polished jewels. The rest of them are just a bunch of goddamn rocks, and you got to throw them back in the river." And that's kind of the way I look at you guys. Some of you at the end of this trainee program are going to be polished jewels. The rest of you, we're going to throw your asses back in the river. And we just looked at each other and we were like, "Oh boy."
How many people were in the room?
There was six of us in the trainee group.
That's a small group.
Yeah. Yeah. That's all they had. The group each year was about 6 to 8 people. And this was the first year they'd started back up. They quit doing the trainee program for about 10 years. And that was the first year they started it back up. And there was just six of us there.
You guys are looking around like, whoa.
Yeah. Which one of us is the rock?
So did you all travel together?
Yeah. Yeah.
Oh, so you guys got to know each other.
Well, yeah. Now, we didn't travel together always. Like, you know, they'd let you go home on the weekends most of the time. Mm-hmm. And so then, you know, the next week you made arrangements to drive or fly to where you were going next.
Okay.
And so, you know, you might meet them there once you got there. Now, there were other times where during the week you would travel from one place to another. And usually what they did then is rented a van. And we would drive that van with all of us together to go to the next place.
Hmm. That sounds pretty interesting.
Yeah. So, yeah, we all knew each other very well by the end of that year.
Did you figure out who was the rocks?
Well, I guess you could say that we had, by the time I went to actual work for the railroad, I mean, you know, out of the trainee program and working around, within 3 years, there was only three of us left still working for the railroad out of six.
After how long?
Yeah, after about 2 years.
Oh, really?
Yeah, there was only 50% of us had survived that long, and none of them were still out supervising. I was the only one still out supervising train crews. One had gotten a job in the marketing department. Another one had gotten a job in some kind of administrative department. So none of them were out on the ground, which is what they were hired us for in the first place. And, you know, what do you expect? One of the guys, he came out of, like, Harvard Business School. And you think he's going to want to work third shift in Logan, West Virginia, managing train crews? You know, he's not going to do that. So, you know, they needed to kind of get their criteria. They needed to get more low-level guys like me that would stick around that didn't have as many options. You didn't want to get these guys that could reach for the stars. But the other thing that happened during my trainees training, whenever there was a strike, the union would go on strike. The railroad, in their infinite wisdom, would say, "Well, by God, we're not going to kowtow to the unions. We're going to go ahead and operate the railroad to the best of our ability." And they would make all the supervisors go out and run the trains, mm-hmm, and service the customers and do all that kind of stuff. Now, like I say, most of the people came out of the ranks. So you had people that were actually qualified engineers running trains. And you had people that were actually trainmen out there working as trainmen. The problem is some of those guys had not been on an engine or a train for 20 years.
Where do I shovel the coal in?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, depending on how long they had been promoted and done, they hadn't done it a long time. And this is not something that you learn how to do it and 20 years later walk back in and do it right.
Yeah.
It takes a while, you know.
I bet the workplace accidents went up exponentially during that time.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Derailments and accidents and everything. It's a wonder nobody ever got killed. But here I was a trainee. Now, we started July 1st, and as I remember, this happened around the end of October, 1st of November, something like this, when this strike started. So we had gone through 1 week of brakeman's training where they teach you how to couple an air hose and do radio rules, because radio rules are all covered by the FCC. You have to do it in certain ways.
How to operate a glad hand.
Yeah, how to operate a glad hand and a knuckle and change a knuckle and, you know, set a handbrake and all the kind of stuff involved with it. Now, none of us were running engines at that time. We did take that training later. But at the time, we had all learned our brakeman's training work. So I had to go out to Fairmont, West Virginia, and work in this strike. Didn't have any idea where I was or what I was doing or anything else. So I was just completely at the mercy of the guys I was working with, that they tell me the right things to do. So we had to go up this coal mine and load a train at the coal mine. We derailed twice while we were loading this train. I mean, and it was because the coal had piled up and it was higher than the rails.
So you knocked the train off the tracks twice?
The train came off the track. And so we're like, well, we got to try to get this thing back on. We got to get this train back in. We can't leave it up here. So we go searching around. I found a refrigerator door in the woods laying around. As you know, in West Virginia, there's refrigerators and sinks and everything else laying around in the hollers.
Yeah.
So I find a refrigerator door and
it's
I bring it over.
It's like Fallout.
Yeah. I said, do you think we can use this? So we put it down and backed the train up over it, and it lifted it up enough to get the wheel back up over the rail and drop back in place.
Huh.
So we proceeded loading, and so it did the same thing again later on before we finished loading the train. So they said, hey, Smurl, go find that refrigerator door.
Smurl, go get your door.
And we re-railed the train again with the refrigerator door. So when you're leaving out of there, the mine is always up a spur track. You know, you leave the main line and right. Go up to the mine. Now, whenever you leave the main line, you have to put the switches back for the main line, because this was in dark territory, which means the dispatcher couldn't see it. Mm-hmm. He couldn't line the switches, and you didn't have signals. You got permissions from the dispatcher to move through. He issued you permissions to move through certain areas.
Right.
So he gave us permission to go up there and leave the switch to go up the mine. But when we came back, he said, you've got to put that back because I need to have the main line. So when trains come through, they don't derail at the switch you left lined against them. Or they go running up the spur with a full train or something. So they said, okay, Smurl, you stay back here in the caboose. When we get down to the bottom of the hill, you let us know when we're clear, and then you get off and line that switch back and lock it, and then get back on the caboose and let us know when you're ready, and we'll go. I said, okay, I can do that.
Fair enough. Seems easy.
Yeah. So we start going down that hill, and as we're going down the hill, I notice we're going faster and faster, and normally coming out of these spur tracks aren't built real well.
Yeah, and they're not serviced as much probably either, right?
Right. It's not mainline track. So
they don't have trains that travel at full speeds on them.
Exactly.
You're creeping in and out.
It's like 15, 20 miles an hour is about max speed going through there. And I'm looking out the window, and I say I've only been there a few months. I'm no expert, but this doesn't look good. This is not Amtrak. And those trees are going by pretty fast. So I'm hanging off the back of that caboose. Now, let me tell you this, too. It was about 38 degrees in drizzling rain all night. I didn't have appropriate rain gear, so I'm soaked to the bone, freezing to death. And I'm hanging on the back of this thing, looking out there with the rain beating me in the face. And I'm looking, and I'm like, I think we're coming up on the switch. And I'm shining my lantern and trying to see it. And we're coming up, and it's like, you know, you're supposed to count them down as you get close. And the first time I saw that switch, we were about 20 cars from it. And I go, 20 cars to the switch, over. No response. 10 cars, 5 cars, that'll do. Still moving.
Just gone.
We're still going. And I haven't gotten a response yet. I've never heard from anybody yet. Well, what I didn't know was the engineer had let the train run away. He had used up, I won't get into the whole explanation, but he had used up the air and let the train get away from him, and he didn't have control of the train. And it was going to be a while before he got control of the train. Well, as we come back out on the main line, I'm looking at that switch disappearing in the distance that I have to line back. And I'm like, are you guys stopping? At this point, the radio rules are out the window. There's no overs and outs. Are you guys stopping? Hey, I got to get this switch. Hey, are you all still up there?
Where did you leave?
And I said, finally, I was like, look, I'm getting off and go get that switch. Stop when you can. And I dove off the back of the caboose. Because, I mean, it was out of sight, and I'm already thinking, I got to walk all the way back there, and then I'm going to have to come back to the train.
You dove off of the speeding train?
I dove off of that caboose, and it was a big embankment, you know, with the rocks. They call it ballast on the railroad, but all those rocks that are piled around the railroad tracks are called ballast. So I dove off and slid down that hill of rocks, just tumbled down it and rolled till I finally came to a stop at the bottom against a bunch of trees. Climbed back up the rocks up to the track, and I look, and I can barely see in the distance the red light of the caboose flashing way off in the distance. Because this is nighttime.
Yeah.
And I can barely see it flashing way off in the distance. And I'm like, hey, guys, I hope you're stopping. I'm off the train now. I survived the jump. I'm going back to get the switch. So I had to hike all the way back up.
Did they respond to that at least?
No, I still never got a response. So I go all the way back up, line the switch and lock it, and start walking back for what seemed like miles. And I'm just walking and walking and walking. Finally, way off in the distance, I see a flashing light, and I hear somebody go, hey, Smurl? Hey, Smurl, are you still back there? And I'm like, finally, life, there is someone. Yes, I'm here. So you ready to go yet? I said, I'll be back there shortly. What happened? We'll talk about it later. They didn't want to say on the radio they had let the train run away. So I hiked, I don't know how many, 2 or 3 miles before I finally found the back of the train and was able to get on there. And oh man, that was a disaster. Then I won't go into the details, but pulling in the yard, we derailed the entire train. I mean, piled up cars on top of cars, where there was like 14 cars derailed and piled up on top of each other and coal all over the place. And they had, when the air dumped, they had me walk the train to try to find what's wrong. And it was like, it was only 3 cars back from the engine, but they didn't get off the engine. They didn't want to go out in the rain. They just ordered me around. So I had to walk from the back all the way up. I get up to the front. Once again, the radio rules go out the window. It's like, God damn it, they're piled up everywhere. And the guy goes, radio rules, radio rules. And I said, over?
Did they say anything to you about jumping off of a train?
No, I mean, what could they say? They let the train run away. Where I said, why didn't you stop? Train got away from me. That was all I could do.
They didn't say, like, you idiot. Why did you jump off a train into rocks? Why didn't you wait till it stopped?
Well, if I'd have gotten hurt, they probably would have said that. But since I survived, they were just glad we were done.
Did they not tell, like, to me, that sounds like a story that they would pass down to all the different people at work. Did you hear about that time Smurl jumped off the train?
You don't want to confess anything. I mean, there was even a time I'm back here in Caboose and I'm smelling something smoking. And I'm like, what is that? There's smoke. And I go out and I look. I had forgotten to release the handbrake on the car just ahead of the caboose. So the wheel's starting to smoke where the train's moving and dragging this car and all the smoke's filling up the caboose. And I'm like, oh, I can't live like this. So I jumped from the front of the caboose to the back of that car over on the ladder while the train was still going and climbed up and knocked the handbrake off while it was going. So I climbed back down and jumped back to the caboose. Now, jumping to the ladder wasn't too bad because I was jumping in. Mm-hmm. Having to jump back to the caboose was hard because I had to jump out because it has a slanted railing that comes out from the steps, whereas the ladder on the car is straight up and down. So it was harder to jump out to it than it was back. Now, I was lucky I had still had good knees in those days, and I was pretty spry.
Well, no wonder you don't have good knees now.
Beat myself up out there. But it's a wonder that more of us didn't die during that, is all I can say.
You know, I just think about this from a law point of view as an attorney and somebody who does, negligence work. I got to tell you, if I represented a client or I had to defend the railroad, and it was during a time when you yahoos are out there jumping from trains and all this stuff, and you guys injured somebody, I mean, and God forbid killed somebody because of an accident, I mean, good Lord, the liability would be huge because there'd be no defense to that on the railroad's part because you have somebody who's not really trained to do this job out there operating this huge piece of machinery just because you want to keep it going.
Well, now let me clarify that most people out there are not as stupid or as ambitious as I was. So they would have just called and said, hey, can you stop the train? I didn't want to admit that I'd forgotten the handbrake. So
talking about how they let the air go out of it. I mean, about if they like ran through something somehow and killed somebody.
Yeah, that's possible. If they didn't have permission to get back out where they were going, you know, from the dispatcher, they could have had a head on collision with another train if there'd been another train that
could have been Amtrak or a passenger train too, right?
Sure.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, it could have been huge. I mean, the liability from that is just crazy. I can't imagine they would still do that in this day and age.
I don't know. I being away from it for as long as I have, I don't know if they still do, but all I can say is, yes, it has operated extremely unsafe during times when they make the officers come out and run the trains. They may be the supervisors, that doesn't mean they're the best ones at that job, and especially after they haven't done it for a long time.
That's crazy.
It is.
Well, I think we're going to have some law stories as well, but I think before we get to law stories, I think there might be a couple pending motions.
Well, there is one motion if we can approach the caboose.
Let's throw the line switch and get into some advertisements.
Try not to run away.
That's right.
Well, we have with us our good friends from Robinhood.
Now, Robinhood is an investing app that lets you buy and sell stocks, ETFs, options, and cryptos, all commission-free.
They strive to make financial services work for everyone, not just the wealthy 1%.
And the best thing is, it's a non-intimidating way for stock market newcomers to invest for the first time with true confidence.
It's simple and intuitive and has clear design with data presented in an easy-to-digest way.
Now, in case you missed it the first time we said it, there's no cost, no commission fees. Other brokerages charge up to $10 for every trade, but Robinhood doesn't charge commission fees. Trade stocks and keep all of your profits.
The design and ease of use. It's so easy to understand with the charts and market data. You can place a trade in just 4 taps on your smartphone. And Michael, I think you have done some on yours, haven't you?
I have. It's super simple. Now, Robinhood web platform also lets you view stock collections. This is really cool. You can check out the 100 most popular sectors like entertainment, social media, and curated categories like female CEOs, and analyst ratings of buy, hold, sell for every stock.
Now, the best thing is you can learn by doing it. Learn how to invest as you build your portfolio.
You can discover new stocks and track favorite companies with personalized newsfeed.
Custom notifications for price movements so you never miss the right moment to invest.
Now, here is the deal. Robinhood is giving listeners a free stock like Apple, Ford, or Sprint to help build your portfolio right now.
That's unbelievable. A free stock of one of those big companies?
In this day and age?
Unbelievable. It's huge.
So sign up now at court.robinhood.com.
That's court.robinhood.com. Trade on Mike and Tommy.
There you go. All right, now, I picked out a couple of different lawyer stories to tell, and I'm sad to say I don't think that they are nearly as funny as your story is jumping off of a train.
Or maybe everybody lived, though.
I actually was not going to tell this story because it just didn't occur to me.
But I raised the bar, huh?
But you've raised the bar. And with your physical comedy, I feel like I need to add some physical comedy as well.
All right. Step right up, pal.
So I was in court in a neighboring county, and we had finished up court for the day, so the judge wasn't on the bench. And I had had a civil case that day, and I was talking to my client, and the judge had sentenced somebody to prison during that session of court. They came in there, they were on some sort of bond or something pending sentencing, and the judge sentenced to prison. So basically the bailiff took them into custody, meaning they didn't come from the jail when they came to court that day, but they were going to jail when they left. So yeah. I was standing there talking. The court people had kind of emptied out, and there was probably maybe 15, I don't even say 15, maybe 10 people in the courtroom. And I was standing by the door, and this courtroom in particular, there's a metal detector when you come into the courtroom, and it's through one of the doors. It doesn't even work, I don't think. Nobody uses it. There's no metal detectors at this courthouse, actually. They don't have them there. Most courthouses have metal detectors. This one doesn't, because it's kind of more of a rural courthouse.
And everybody carries a gun anyway.
Yeah.
So there's no reason to check.
Yeah. So I'm standing there talking to my client, and I see that this guy who just got sentenced to prison is standing there, and he's up there by the bailiff, and he's kind of talking to what I think is his mom. And all of a sudden, I see him take off running, and I hear the mom say, it's like, no, Jerry, no. And so he's basically decided he's going to run. And so the bailiff takes handcuffs and throws them at the guy as he's running and misses him.
That's not how those work.
The guy turns the corner as he comes around the last row. I swear it was like one of those like cartoon type things where, like when they make that turn, they're kind of coming around.
And their legs are going around in a circle.
Yeah. Crashes into the metal detector, comes right past me, and goes out the door, and then the door flies open, and then he runs, and right there, I mean, there is the stairway right there. I mean, he was basically gone at that point, mm-hmm. but he runs into two home confinement officers who just happened to be standing there after court talking, and they tackle him. They all go into a pile onto the ground.
Wow.
Now, the other officer, the bailiff who threw the handcuffs, comes running around the corner. He piles on top of this guy, too. Now, this guy is a pretty good-sized dude.
Was it a late hit? Did call a penalty?
It was definitely a late hit. This guy's a pretty good-sized dude, and he's giving them all they want. And I'm kind of standing there watching him, and I train jiu-jitsu, so I'm pretty adept at grappling. And I'm thinking, I could probably go help these guys, but I don't know if I want to. I don't want them to think I'm somebody coming up to try to interfere with them doing their job. I mean, even though I know them, I didn't know what would happen in the spur of the moment. They don't see somebody in a uniform. They're like, who's this guy?
Yeah.
So somebody goes, Mike, here are the handcuffs. And they hand me the handcuffs that he had thrown at the guy. So I got these handcuffs, and I start walking up very slowly. I was like, I have handcuffs. May I approach? they're like, yes, get up here.
Judge has to rule on that.
So I come walking up, and they're trying to get his arms behind him, and they finally get around, and they're like, put the cuff on him. And I was like, okay. And so I end up cuffing the guy.
Did you do it like they do in the movies where they kind of like slap them, like the wrist slap, and they snap, or did you have to like just close them around there?
No, I just closed them. I did not do it confidently.
Oh, man.
I pushed them shut, and I said, book them, Dano.
At least he didn't go over the rail like that. At least he didn't go over the rail like that one dude that they posted on our Facebook page.
Yeah. There actually is videotape of it, too, and you can see me very sheepishly walking up and putting the cuffs on. And they actually charged a guy with fleeing, and they listed me as a witness. I thought I was going to actually have to testify in court. And the prosecuting attorney kept saying, we listed you as a witness. And I said, all right, go ahead. You're going to get me up there. I'm just going to tell you. I'm going to testify. I ain't no rat.
I plead the fifth.
It's like, you're going to ruin my street cred.
Yeah.
So that's my physical comedy story.
Well, that's pretty good. I didn't know you were involved in such a thing.
Yeah. Yeah. I got to actually handcuff somebody. So.
Yep. Practically makes you a superhero.
Ah, no. I mean, I did actually, when he tripped, I shot him with my webbing from my hand. That's actually what tripped him. One other story I have, which is kind of a quick one, doing defense work. This was pretty early in my career. I was doing some criminal defense work, and I had this, it was probably the biggest felony case I had up to this point. I went to visit the guy in jail and talked to him, and I said, we were talking about the case and things like that. And he's like, yeah. He goes, I talked to the police before this and blah, blah, blah. He goes, they asked me if I'd do a lie detector test. And I said, oh, yeah. And I said, did you do one? He's like, no. And I said, oh, okay. And I made the stupidest mistake of my young legal career. I said, well, why not? And he stopped and looked at me. And he said, well, I have very vivid dreams. I'm afraid that my dreams would make it so I looks like I'm lying. And at that point, I knew he was guilty of sin. and I've never asked that question of any client ever again since then.
That reminds me of a Christmas lesson that I learned.
What's that?
Well, when I was still young and, I was right at that point where I wasn't too sure about Santa Claus. You know, I was probably 18 or 19. No.
I was like, wait a second.
7 or 8, something like that. And so I'm starting to have my doubts about Santa Claus. Well, I had gotten my usual haul there for Christmas, you know. And so it was...
One soda from Dan Smurl.
That's right. So it was a couple weeks after Christmas, and I'm down in our basement, and we're playing and doing some things around. I look up on a shelf that they had storage stuff on, and there was the boxes from some of the things that Santa had given me.
Uh-oh.
That had been sitting under the tree Christmas morning. And I see the boxes, and Dad happened to be down there, and I said, Dad, how come the boxes from the gifts that Santa gave us are sitting up there on the shelf? He looked down at me, and he said, son, don't ask questions you don't want to know the answers to. So I never asked again.
I can see your dad saying that.
Neither confirm nor deny. So I've used that philosophy in life several times.
I can actually hear your dad's voice actually saying that, which is the funny part.
With that deep Southern drawl.
Yeah, your dad has a very distinctive way of talking. And yeah, like very deep Southern drawl.
Yeah. But the next place I went after my trainee program. Actually, this is where I was stationed during my trainee program. But then after you finish, then you go work for a little bit there. Mm-hmm. So I went to Grafton, West Virginia.
Oh, I remember visiting you all there.
Oh, that was up in the hills, right in the middle of West Virginia, up in the hills in the middle of nowhere. I mean, it's a little podunk town with no interstates or anything. You have to drive back roads in there for over an hour to get to it from the nearest interstate.
It's right by Bridgeport's where you get off, right?
Right. Well, that's where most people lived, was in Bridgeport. Mm-hmm. And then they drive into Grafton because there's nothing in Grafton. There's the hillside and there's the river. Mm-hmm. And that's all there is. And you're on the hillside going down to the river. In between there. That's it.
It's like one of those places in West Virginia when they say you have to go there and like, oh, you can't get there from here.
That's right. You only see the sun at noon. That's it. After that, you don't see it before or after. It's just noon. That's it. So anyway, I go there and of course, it's the same thing. Here's a young guy and he's coming in and they had me filling in. They were going to send the guy that was a nighttime train master off to do some educational training. So that he could, you know, maybe be promoted down the road. So they had me filling in for that month on that job. So he took me around for about a week to show me what to do and everything. And so I thought, okay, well, this isn't too tough. And the first thing he'd do every night is sit down and draw out where to put every car in the yard and then hand that to the yard master. And the yard master then would direct the crews.
Okay.
So the first night that I'm there in charge, they hand me the list with all the cars in the yard. And I went over to the yard master, and I said, do you know where these should go? And he said, well, yeah, I've been here 25 years. And I said, well, you fill out the list then and do that. You're not going to do it? I said, if you know how to do it, why should I? I don't know, but the other guy never lets me.
Yeah.
I said, well, tonight you got your chance.
Yeah, here's your big chance.
Yeah, that's right. So I learned to delegate real fast. Don't try to tell people how to do things that have been doing it 25 years.
Yeah.
You know, let them do it. And he thought he'd gotten promoted, basically.
Yeah.
And for me, I didn't know what the heck to do anyway, you know. So that worked out well. The only bad part, though, my first night out there, we had two derailments on the yard. And I was able to get one of them re-railed, not with a refrigerator door. We had actual re-railers that we could use. Re-railers are like these metal things that you can strap to the track, and they have a reverse flange like on them that if you're not too far from the rail, if you just dropped in on the rail so the wheels are still close, you can put this down and pull the train in the opposite direction, and it'll pull the wheels back up and on.
Does it look like a refrigerator door?
No, it doesn't even look like one.
Okay.
They look like individual speed bumps.
Oh, okay.
Because the wheels on a car are on what they call a truck, and that's the four wheels. You got two axles, a front axle and a back axle, mm-hmm. and that's four wheels, and they comprise a truck. So you have two trucks on each car, a front truck and a back truck. So as long as those wheels drop in just barely, you can use your re-railers and pull them back up. So that makes it easy. Most of the time, the derailments I saw, very rarely could you ever use re-railers because the cars were piled up on top of everything. You got to be moving at a slow speed and stop right away to be able to use that. So one of them we were able to re-rail, the other we weren't. But I felt like a complete failure the next morning when I had to report to the division manager that we'd had two derailments. And he said, well, at least it wasn't like my first night on the railroad as a supervisor. And I said, what was that? And he was working at Newport News, Virginia. Mm-hmm. And there they have... They have a car float where they put cars. The track leads down to the ocean where they have a ferry, and they would roll cars onto this ferry and move them to another location. So they got a car derailed with the front trucks on the ferry and the rear trucks on the land, and the car was derailed. So they're sitting there scratching their heads as what to do, and he's the new guy, first night on duty, and this is his job. And he said, down there, since they're by the water, they called the supervisors. They always call them Cap. The mm-hmm. union guys would call them Cap. So he walked down there and saw what was going on. And the old conductor that was down there had been there forever. And he said, well, Cap, what you want to do? And he goes, he thought he was being real smart. See, he thought, well, I know what I'll do. He said, just why don't you go ahead and do whatever you did last time this happened and let's fix it that way. He figured, that'll fix it.
Yeah.
And the guy looked at him and goes, I've been here 35 years, Cap. This ain't never happened before. That's just the way those things ran. But then I got my first assignment after Grafton, went to Baltimore, and worked in a clerical, supervising clerks, because you had different levels of people. You had trainmen, you had clerical people and stuff like that that worked in the T&E. So they put me in a data center that basically we supervise clerks, and the clerks help transfer all the information relating to the trains. I worked a swing shift where it was one daytime, two evenings, and two midnights. Well, on the midnight, whenever I worked there, there was a guy that had been there a long time and chose to work midnight. He wanted to work midnight. I mean, he had seniority to hold a daytime job, but he liked working midnights. So he was there, and he knew that Wednesday night was one of my midnights, and he knew that it was 2-for-1 pizza night at this like 7-Eleven place. And he knew if I was there, that was a pretty good deal. So we would split the pizza. We would, you know, I'd pay half, he'd pay half, and he'd go get the two pizzas, 2-for-1. Mm-hmm. He'd come in and sit in my office, and we'd sit there and talk and eat them. Now, this guy, his name was Will Hemphill. He was 6'9", 350 pounds.
He could eat some pizza, I bet.
He could eat some pizza, but he was a huge guy. And I always noticed when he walked around, he always carried about 3 fusees in his back pocket. And fusees are what, on the railroad, that's what you call them, fusees. Most people would know them as flares. You know, they look like sticks of dynamite. And, you know, you light them and everything. And I thought, you know, train crews carry those that have to do with flagging trains and stuff if you are in an emergency or something. Why is my clerk carrying around fusees with him? So I said, one night I asked him, I said, Will, how come you carry those fusees in your pocket? And he always called me Mr. Smurl. Mm-hmm. And he said, even though he was an older guy and I was about 25, and he goes, well, Mr. Smurl, let me tell you this. When I'm out there at night checking those cars, anybody come walking up on me, they're going to get about 6 inches of lit fusee right up their ass. And I'm like, Will, anybody come walking up on you, they'd have to be nuts. 6'9", 350 pounds, I'd go the other way. Guy was huge, but that was why he carried it around. He was had his own self-defense plan there.
He had a plan.
Yeah. But we had some guys that weren't very bright. One of the things, most of the trains that came in, they would come, the main line coming into Baltimore, you had to check all the trains. So usually they'd make them slow down, and so they pulled by, and we would have a guy out there because we didn't have any mechanization or no microchips or anything like that to get the train numbers. So you would have a person stand out there with like a notebook and physically write down every number on the car as a train went by.
Oh, geez.
Then you'd go in, and we had to cut data cards, old cardboard. I don't know if you've ever seen them. They're old cardboard cards, and we had to feed those into a reader. It was like the old punches, the hanging chads from the voting in Florida. It was like those, but they contained the numbers, and that was how they transmitted the data on them. So you'd go out and do that. Some of the trains, though, were running on schedule, and they were particularly hot trains. So you did this thing called get the last three numbers. So you would just get the last three numbers, kind of like a Social Security thing. You know, when they say, what's the last four of your social? You get the last three of the car. So you just write down the last three off of each car. So then you could go to the previous list and kind of match it up and see that everything was right.
Yeah.
We had a clerk there one night, and, you know, he'd been there a long time, so everybody assumes you know the lingo. And he said, we told him, get the last three on such train that's going by. He goes out there, and he's out there, and he comes back in a little bit later, and he goes, here you go. And he hands the supervisor the list, and he looks at it, and he says, what's this? And he said, you said get the last three numbers. He had written down the last three cars, the numbers on the last three cars of the train, the whole number, but the last three cars, that was it. And the guy's like, what is this? He goes, that's the last three cars. That's what you told me to get. And he's like, what am I going to do with this? You're an idiot. You know,
it's Mr. Literal.
We had a lot of those kind of people.
I guess I could kind of understand that, maybe confusion, but if you hadn't been doing it for 20 years.
Yeah. Well, that's what the guy had been a clerk for a long time. It wasn't like he was a brand new clerk. Now, maybe he had never worked that assignment, and everybody just assumed everybody knows everything. Because there is a lot of assuming that goes on the railroad.
So back to some law stories here.
Yeah.
I used to do a lot of depositions because I was an attorney for doing workers' comp, and I was a claimant's attorney. It was a mill. We had a ton of cases. I mean, I think we had like 400 cases between two attorneys. I mean, a lot of files. So I was basically the deposition guy. I went to all the depositions. And part of my job is going to the depositions was I'd always have to prep the client before we'd go to the deposition. It wouldn't be strange for me to have two or three depositions in a day. Mm-hmm. Then the rest of the day was spent pretty much prepping people to go to deposition. So I became an expert in depositions. I had a standard spiel I'd always tell people. And I say, well, they're going in, they're going to take your deposition. And these are people who had been hurt on the job. So it was kind of was more about geared towards that. They'd ask them where they lived. They'd ask them what their education was. And then, you know, I'd always say, like, they're going to ask you, where'd you go to school? They're going to ask you, what was your first job? How much did you make there? After that, where'd you go? How much did you make there? Just basically because they're trying to get a baseline to how much this person made, because that's how you compute kind of what their lost earnings are, is based on money. And also to determine whether or not they might need any kind of vocational retraining, if they have any skills they could do from before. Then they'd ask about the current job and, like, well, how'd you get hurt on the job, and get their side of the story. They'd ask about treatment. Well, where'd you go for treatment after that? And they'd go all the way through treatment up until the present day. Mm-hmm. They'd ask about treatment you had before the accident. Then they'd say, well, did you ever have any treatment before that? And so kind of go backwards. And then they'd say, activities. Well, what do you like to do for hobbies? And, you know, these people are hurt. So they'd say, well, you know, I can't do many hobbies now because I'm hurt. That's what they almost always said. And I said, well, okay, what kind of hobbies did you like to do before? What did you do before? Well, you know, I used to, I like to play sports. I'd play basketball. And, like, what about around the house? Well, you know, I'd like to cut the grass and take the trash out, do laundry, vacuum. No problems doing that? No problems doing that. How about now? Oh, I can't do it. You know, I can't vacuum, can't do things like that. Can't cut the grass, can't take out the trash. So I would tell people this in prep. Those are all your standard kind of questions.
Right.
I said, now, if they start asking you really specific questions about your activities, kind of pay attention, because there's a good chance they've taken video surveillance of you and they might have you on film doing this. And you don't want to lie during your deposition. So, and I always said that, is like, if they ask you some real strange questions, like, you know, have you ever worked on a 1974 Cadillac Eldorado? That's not your standard question they ask. So pay attention and think to yourself, have I ever worked on a 1974 Cadillac Eldorado in the near future? You know, so I go into this one deposition and they ask all the standard questions. They ask, you ever work on cars? And the guy's like, nope, never work on cars. And they said, so you don't ever work on cars? You don't ever do any, install any stereos for any people or anything like that? Nope, never do that. Never, don't have a side business, never make any money doing that. And they're also trying to figure out if this person's making any money on the side too.
Right.
Or doing any work. And the guy's like, nope, don't ever do it. So, like, you never installed a stereo or speakers or anything like that. And they said the kind of car, I forget what it was. The guy's like, nope, never did it.
I'm like, my twin brother might have.
Yeah. I'm thinking to myself, oh my gosh, they definitely have video of this guy. Yeah. So we finish up the depo. The client leaves. I look at the other attorney. I'm like, all right, where's the video? He's like, I'll send it to you. And he sends me the video a couple days later. I pop it in. And sure enough, there's my client. It shows him coming out of his yard. He literally hops over a fence in a single bound. And this guy has supposedly had this horrible back injury. He goes to this car. He crawls in through the trunk. Like, and he's in there and he's wiring upside down, wiring stuff and all this. And I'm just like, oh geez, he was lying. But, so obviously that case got settled pretty quick for not very much.
Yeah, I guess so.
But the story always went that whenever they had a good video and they had something good to your client, they'd send over the video with a bag of microwave popcorn for you to enjoy it. I never actually saw that. I don't know if that was actually true or not, but that was the story that they always told.
You never got the popcorn
though. No, if you get a video with a bag of popcorn, get ready, because it's going to be a good one. So now, during my deposition days, I also had another funny story. One of the questions they always standardly ask people is, do you drink alcohol? Because they're trying to find out if people drink or abuse drugs, which could possibly make you not heal as quick or things like that. And I had this... this lady, and she had an accent. She was from somewhere in Europe. She had a pretty thick accent. And they said, do you drink? And she's like, no, I do not drink. And so they're like, okay. They keep asking questions. And then something comes up, and she said that she had a glass of wine. And the attorney's like, aha. Says, well, you said you didn't drink. Why? You just said you had a glass of wine. What is it? Do you drink? Do you not drink? Thinking they'd really caught her. Mm-hmm. She went on a tirade about how drinking wine is not really drinking, that is a sacrament to her, and she has it with meals every day. and that she doesn't drink, but that's her sacrament, and that's what she does.
Well, yeah, some parts of Europe, they drink wine with every meal. Even the kids drink wine.
Yeah, it was pretty interesting, though, that she was very indignant with this guy.
She schooled him, huh?
Yeah, this he was a younger attorney, too, because they had the younger attorneys doing this kind of work. This younger whippersnapper attorney trying to catch her up. He's like, nope, that's my sacrament. So whenever I have wine with a meal, I always think about that deposition, how this is, well, I'm not really drinking. This is a sacrament.
Yeah, this is free. Well, when I moved on from Baltimore, I went to Richmond. Now, in Richmond, I was only there 10 months before I made my next move. But the thing that I encountered that stuck out in my mind the most from there was, you know, the railroaders, the union did this to themselves, the downsizing of crews. When I first started with the railroad, you had 5 people on a train crew. You had an engineer and a fireman. You had a conductor, a brakeman, and a flagman. Mm-hmm. By the time I left, you had an engineer and conductor. That's it.
Yeah.
But they demonstrated that all these people were riding around on the train. You didn't need them, you know? And especially with a lot of the mechanization was taking place with power switches and things like that, you didn't have the kind of work before that you used to. Plus, you could use taxis and things like that to help move people around.
I'm glad my mom didn't have a power switch when I was growing up.
Yeah, that's right. You had to cut your own, didn't you?
That's right.
But so at the time, though, they still had quite a few people on the crew. So I would walk into the yard. This is, again, I'm working third shift. That's the other thing. As a young supervisor, you get all the third shifts.
Right.
So I'm going in third shift, and I walk into the yard office, and here's like about 8 guys sitting around playing poker. Well, first of all, it's in the rule book, you don't play poker. You can't play cards of any time while on duty.
Yeah.
So here were several members of the yard crew, plus a couple guys from like the mechanical department, because you always had mechanical people out there that did the inspection on cars and stuff like that, fixed cars, if you will, and things. So here was about 8 of them sitting around playing poker. And I'm like, you guys can't play poker. You put that away. And they're like, oh, nobody else ever says anything to us. And I just got on. I said, that's it. Put the cards away. Go back to work. And if I catch you again, I'm going to write you up. They're like, oh, you know, they were this guy. He's not from here. And he's doing this. You know, the other one, Pug, would never do this. Pug was the other guy that worked out there.
Pug's cool.
Yeah, Pug. He's played cards with us before. You know, all of it, they sell you out, you know, and you get them. So anyway, so I broke it all up, and I thought, well, that should be the end of that when I'm working. I walked in like 2 nights later in the yard office. Look, here's basically the same guy sitting around playing cards. And I said, I told you all I was going to write you up if I caught you. And I said, here you are playing cards again. No, we're not. I said, well, what do you have there? And there was one guy who was getting ready to deal. He said, I'm just playing solitaire while I'm on my break. And I said, well, what's that pile of money in the middle? And they looked at each other and said, oh, we don't know. I said, there's just a pile of money laying there? And they said, yeah. I walked over and picked it up and started organizing it into one pack. Well, that looks like a pretty good stack. I said, well, I guess it was lost. And I guess since I'm the supervisor, I should hang on to it so whoever lost it will come back and claim it, I guess. So I folded it up and put it in my pocket and turned around to walk out. And I hear one guy going, damn, that was the best hand I had all night. And so I walked out with the money. So I thought, surely this has cured them. But I knew where they hid their cards in there. So I waited till all of them were out of the yard office a couple nights later. And I went back in and I looked up under the table. And sure enough, up under a brace, a support up under the table, there was the deck of cards wedged in up there. So I got the deck of cards out and I went through and I pulled out all 4 aces. And I stuck 4 of my business cards in there, spread them out through the deck. And they gave us business cards. What am I going to do with a business card in the middle of the night in Richmond, Virginia? But I put
probably identify your body after these guys kill you.
But I put 4 business cards in and put them back up there where they hit it.
You're lucky you didn't end up with a fusee where the sun don't shine.
So a few days later, I went into one of the guys that was one of the ringleaders, and I said, you guys still playing cards in here, or have you decided to quit? And he goes, nah, somebody messed our deck up. They took out the 4 aces and replaced it with 4 jokers.
That's pretty clever.
Yeah, so that was my Richmond story. So I went from there to Cincinnati. I was at Cincinnati, and they call that yard there Queensgate. And it was one of the most, it was the most modern hump yard on the railroad. Mm-hmm. Now, one of the guys that was there that sticks out in my mind was a guy named Dornbush, and everybody called him Dorney. He was dumber than a box of rocks. I mean, if something could be screwed up, he would screw it up. And what they would do, they had two crews that worked out on the humps while you were humping cars. So a lot of times what they would do is they would work together so one guy could be freed up to run, go pick up lunch for everybody else when it was lunchtime. Uh-huh. And they wouldn't stop working. They would just cover for each other so the guy would do it. And we'd let them do it even though we weren't supposed to. We'd let them do it because it kept them happy and kept them working. So one night, Dorney was the guy that went to go get the lunch. So he comes back and he's got all the bags of food and he's putting it all down and he's saying, okay, here's your change and here's yours. And he's handing them all out. And he comes up to the one guy and he sets down like two big bags in front of him and a Coke. And a guy looks at him. He goes, where's my change? He says, change? You owe me another $25. And he said, $25? All I ordered was two cheesesteaks and a Coke. He said, it wasn't two, it was 11. And he goes, what do you mean it was 11? He reaches in his pocket and he pulls a note out and he said, look right there, that's 11.
Oh, my gosh.
No, that's two marks that was put down there for two. And he goes, no, it's not, it's 11. And he said, well, if it's 11, how come up here by the Cokes where there's two marks, you didn't get 11 Cokes? And he goes, don't be stupid. No, some bitch can drink 11 Cokes. You could eat 11 cheesesteaks, but nobody could drink 11 Cokes.
You can't argue with that logic. Oh, my gosh.
Well, that was the type of characters that you had out there. That was unbelievable. I was just glad I wasn't involved. I just heard about it. Even his fellow trainmen were blown away by that. They just couldn't believe that.
Amazing. What's funny is as you tell these stories, I remember coming to visit you and marry at all these different places.
Oh, yeah.
I remember distinctly where you all lived in each of these places.
Yeah.
I remember going to Grafton. I remember you all lived in Bridgeport. I remember the little lake that mm-hmm. was there by your house. So I went fishing there and caught a ton of fish one day. I think we were using like breadcrumbs or hot dogs. Hot dogs, yeah. Yeah, just fish after fish after fish. I remember going to...
with bamboo poles. They weren't even real fishing rods.
We were going to like Baltimore and seeing you all there. Went to D.C. and visited D.C. when mm-hmm. there. Richmond, I remember we played tennis at the tennis courts at the apartment complex you all lived at.
Yeah.
I think there was a pool there, too.
Mm-hmm.
And also, newspaper delivery was twice a day there, I remember.
They had an evening paper, huh?
They did.
Yeah.
That was the first time I'd ever seen that. But yeah, I have like memories from all these different places.
Yeah. Well, from Cincinnati, mm-hmm. I was there for 2.5 years and then went to Waycross, Georgia. Now, Waycross, Georgia is about like Grafton, but in Georgia. It's in the middle of nowhere, and it's also flat. Grafton is hilly. Waycross is flat. As a matter of fact, it's on the Okefenokee Swamp, and it stays hot year-round and humid. It's very humid. It's actually sits below sea level, so the humidity just gathers in there. So it was a very different place. And the thing you find out about when you go down there, you are a Yankee. When you're in Waycross, Georgia, and you're from West Virginia, you're considered a Yankee. Actually, anybody north of Georgia is considered a Yankee.
South Carolina?
Oh, Yankee. Yeah. Yankee. They're all Yankees. And the really funny part is when you cross the border into Florida, they're Yankees too. So, but you hear about that. The war is not over. The Civil War did not end in Georgia. They still talk about it, and they still break you down into Yankees and rebels.
Yeah.
So they let you know about that. And there were some characters there. One of the train masters that I worked with there was a guy named Mississippi Smith. Now, I'm sure Mississippi was not his given name, but that's what everybody called him. And I don't know what his real name was. As far as I know, that's what they had on his paycheck. I don't know, Mississippi Smith. And to him, everybody was Bubba. And he had this deep Southern drawl when he was down there. And he'd, you know, like you're talking to the train and you're in the tower. And it's kind of like being an air traffic controller, but with trains. Mm-hmm. So you're like, okay, Southwest 99, come on in track number 2, bring your train on down to the bottom, and there'll be a car there to pick you up and carry you on in. Over. You got that, Bubba? You know, and that's the way that he talks. Well, I started kind of imitating him, and before long, people couldn't tell whether it was him or me, because what I found is I got better responses when they thought it was him. When they thought it was me, it was like, that's that damn Yankee. And so I'd get all this pushback and get this flack, and people wanted to do something else and stuff. But if they thought it was Mississippi Smith talking, then they went ahead and did what he told you to do. So that worked out fine until one of the crews lodged a complaint, because I kind of got into it with them, and they lodged a complaint about me, but they lodged it on Mississippi because they thought it was Mississippi. And he came up, he said, "Now, boy, I want you to quit. I want you to quit talking like me because you're getting me in trouble."
I'm West Virginia Smurl.
But there was this long, lanky guy that worked there as an assistant trade master. His name was Lee Roberts. And he was just as goofy as could be. He was a great guy, but he was just as goofy as could be. And one night, Mississippi sent him down to pick up a crew off a train. And apparently, some taxi hollered in and said he was in the area. And they said, "Well, you go ahead and get the crew." So Lee goes down there, and he waits and waits. And he goes, "Hey, Mississippi." He said, "I'm down here to get this crew, and nobody's here." And he goes, "Yeah, I already had a taxi pick them up and bring them in." There's this long silence. And then you hear, "Son of a bitch, over." So it's like, you know, just because you say over doesn't forgive that you just cursed on the radio. You can't do that. FCC will come down on you. But I think the funniest thing, there was a guy, he was a real character, worked down at the bowl end, which is the guys that pull the cars out of the thing to make the trains. The cars are humped into the bowl, and the hump crews are humping the cars in, and the bowl crews are pulling the cars out to build the trains. A guy named Travis, and he worked down there. So he got upset because the Cokes in the Coke machine were 50 cents. They came in and raised the price to 55 cents. He thought that was an outrage. He could not believe they raised the price of a Coke to 55 cents. Mm-hmm. So he decided he was going to teach them a lesson. So he went out and he started bringing in two coolers of drinks and selling them to everybody there on the honor system for 50 cents apiece. So he figured he'd put those guys out of business. So he had done that for about a month or so, and it was one particularly hot day. And I go down there to the bowl tower, and I go to go upstairs, and I look in, and here's Travis feverishly feeding quarters into the Coke machine and getting Cokes out and throwing them in his coolers. And I said, "What are you doing?" And he said, "Well, I ran out of drinks." And I said, "So you're buying them out of the machine for 55 cents and throwing them in your cooler and selling them for 50? And he said, "Yeah." He said, "I got to stay in business." I said, "Well, Travis, that's not a very good business model that you got there." And he goes, "Well, I know it looks like it on the surface, but," he said, "to me, it's worth something just being in business."
What?
So he was buying them out of the machine for 55 and throwing them in his cooler and selling them for 50 because he'd run out and he didn't want to disappoint his customers.
He was not the guy from the Harvard Business School that you went to managerial training with.
No, that was not the guy from there. But then I finally got transferred back to Huntington. So I have finished out my career here, or they finished out my career here.
Yeah.
But some of the most interesting things here happened in the officer outings. They would have an officer outing at Glade Springs where we'd go up there for one day of meetings and one day of golf. Mm-hmm. And they would usually just draw names out of the hat and divide us up into teams. We play a scramble. Mm-hmm. There was also a lot of drinking that went on during those scrambles.
I can imagine.
More drinking than golf, usually. There was a few serious golfers, and the rest were serious drinkers. And so one time, there was an assistant train master that was in a golf cart, and he was in there with one of the superintendents. And he had done something that made it so the brakes didn't work. So when he got out of the cart, he was driving, he got out, and the cart started rolling. The superintendent was still in the cart, and it rolled into a lake that was there with the superintendent. Well, he looks up, and he sees the cart rolling in. He goes running towards it, and there was a bunch of us around it saw this happening. And he goes running towards it. We think, oh, at least he's going to help him. He goes running to the back, unhooks his golf clubs, and gets his golf clubs off the cart as it's rolling into the lake with the superintendent.
He had his priorities.
Yeah, he just saved his golf clubs. And everybody was like, "Wow, Ralph, you just got your clubs and you let the superintendent roll in the lake?" Well, it ended up that he ended up getting demoted back into the ranks about a month later.
I wonder if that.
And we were sure that had something to do with it.
I wonder if that had anything to do with it.
Yeah, you learned on those outings that while you thought you were having fun, you had to be really careful. There was another guy. He was a road foreman, which those are the guys that supervise engineers. Mm-hmm. And he was one of those guys that you get a few drinks in him and you put money on the line, and he was a top-notch performer.
Yeah.
I mean, he really was. He rose to the occasion. He started playing the division manager pool, and this division manager fancied himself. That's the top guy on the entire division. He fancied himself a really good pool player. Well, Daryl started beating him, And so he was down to the point where he was about ready to beat him, and they had big money riding on it. And Daryl came over to a couple of us, and he said, "What do you think? Should I go ahead and beat him, or should I let him win? What do you think? This guy, he's the boss. He's the big boss." And a couple of them, "Go ahead, do it. He'll take it all right. He'll understand. It's just competition." And I said, "Daryl, you don't have a hair on your butt if you don't beat him." He went out and beat him, finished him off, and took the money and laughed and went off. The division manager was cool about it, didn't say a word about it. But about a month later, he got transferred to Saginaw, Michigan.
Oh, my goodness.
So I don't think he should have crossed that division manager. He should have let him win.
I've actually been to Saginaw, Michigan.
Yeah, it's not a good place in the winter.
No, it's nice in the summer, though.
Yeah.
The lake's really nice.
Yeah, but the problem is they only have two seasons, winter and July.
I could see it would be cold there. Oh, that's funny. I had a couple of really good stories, but these are from an older attorney that I shared office space with down in Florida.
Yeah.
And he ended up retiring when we were still sharing space, but he told some pretty good stories. Two of my favorites that I remember is he used to do public defender work, and he represented somebody. I can't remember what the crime the guy committed was. It was something like a burglary charge, something like that. And this was like a lifelong criminal. And there were sentencing guidelines for what the judge could sentence this guy to. And the judge sentenced the guy to, I think it was like 25 years or something, like really long. And that was outside the guidelines. It was basically an illegal sentence. Mm-hmm. And so Greg, the attorney, objects. He's like, "Judge, I'm going to object to that sentence. Like, that's an illegal sentence." It's like, "You can't sentence him to that long." He's like, "Well, you can appeal it." I mean, everybody in the room knew it was an illegal sentence. So I can't remember if Greg said he did the appeal or the appellate division of the public defender's office did it. Sure enough, they appeal it. It gets overturned with instructions sent back to the judge to sentence him to the proper term.
Mm-hmm.
So Greg goes back in there and says, "Judge, back here for resentencing. You know, ask you to sentence him to the proper term." Judge says, "Okay, I sentence him to 25 years. He's like, "Judge, they just overturned the decision, said, you know, you had to sentence him properly." He's like, "I know. I'm sentencing 25 years. You can appeal it if you want." Judge just did not care. He had it out for this guy. I don't know if that guy beat him in pool or crashed him into a lake during a golf outing or what, but he just didn't care. So
he's going to get 25 regardless.
Yeah. And another one that Greg told me is he had a case, and I guess it was one of those days where there's just numerous cases, and you're just kind of just basically processing people, like during arraignments in court, and people just line up and you go through, make your appearance, and then keep on moving. So it's kind of like a conveyor belt. And Southern judge down there in Florida, and he said, "Mr. Heimel," he goes, "you know what this reminds me of?" And he's like, "Oh, what's that, judge?" He goes, "This is like dipping cows." And he's like, "Do you know what dipping cows is?" And he's like, "No, I don't." He goes, "Well, that's when you line up a bunch of cows and you send them through a trough, and they get them, it's like liquid, and they go through all the way up to their head, and that's how you dip them so they don't get fleas and ticks."
Yeah, yeah, I've seen that.
"You just line them up and run them through." He goes, "Uh-huh. I feel like we're in here dipping cows today." He's like, "Let's get back to dipping." I always think about that whenever you have these cattle call kind of days where basically it's just you line
them
up,
dip them through.
Yeah, it's kind of the same thing too. It's like, well, keep the fleas and the ticks off of them.
Well, I thought maybe we should finish up with a couple of Christmas stories.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. So, when I first started dating your sister, Mary, my mm-hmm. wife now, you were 2 years old.
I was a little whippersnapper.
So, I have spent a lot of Christmases at your house while you were growing up.
Yeah.
Because that was our favorite place to be. Before we had kids, we'd spend the night up the road, so as we called being at your house up the road,
yeah,
we would spend the night there so that we could see you get up and share the wonder of Christmas morning through the eyes of a young person.
Yeah.
And then when we moved away with the railroad, all those years that we lived away, we would usually figure out a way to come home. So we were there for Christmas and we would stay at your house.
Yeah.
And stay there so we could do that. So one Christmas Eve, you were probably about four, and as is the custom, you buy things for your kid that comes from Santa Claus, and you have a lot of putting together to do.
Yeah.
And this one particular Christmas, your brother Rick was staying there too. Mm-hmm. And we were put in charge of putting together your kitchen. Your parents had gotten you a kitchen for Christmas, and we had to put it together and have it all there for Santa to have gotten it, you know. And so we were in there working on it, and, you know, the usual cursing, kind of like Matt Damon if you saw the SNL skit.
That was really
funny.
Putting
in our house. That's about the way we were. We're putting that kitchen together, and Rick and I are working on it. And if you – well, nobody knows Rick, but Rick is a big bear of a guy.
Yeah.
With a big beard. He's a big burly guy, but he's very soft-spoken and very, you know, very intelligent.
Super cerebral.
Oh, yeah.
College professor.
And he's just – he's built like a rock. I mean, he's just solid. I ran into him once in one of our football games, Turkey Bowl games. And, I mean, I just went to the ground and he didn't move.
The same thing happened to me, too.
It's like running into a wall. But, but anyway, he and I were tasked with putting this together. And we're working on it. And as we're working on it, we looked up and to our horror, here came a four-year-old Michael out of his bed and rubbing his eyes after he had already been in bed for an hour or two, supposed to be asleep. And here he came walking down the hall towards the living room where we were putting it together. And I'm like, oh, no, it's Mike. And Rick jumped up, which he never is a quick mover, but I've never seen him move as fast as he did. He jumped up, throwing out his arms and his legs, and he goes, go back to bed, Michael. Go back to bed, Michael. And, you know, he's quiet. So for him to yell is unusual anyway. But he didn't. He kind of panicked. He didn't know what to do. So he was just trying to shield you from seeing what we're doing. And he was saying, go back to bed. You fell apart. Ah, why is Rick yelling at me? And, of course, here came your mom and dad running up the steps from downstairs where they were wrapping presents or whatever. And they came running upstairs and grabbed you. What are you doing up? What's happened? And everything. Well, Mike got up. Mike got up. And it's like, you got to go back to bed, dude. Santa Claus is going to show up and find you out of bed and you're not going to get anything. And you're like, you're crying. All right, I'll go back to bed. But the next morning, we were like, did you see anything? Because we didn't want to take the magic away from Christmas. All you knew was you were traumatized by Rick. So you didn't see the kitchen or anything else we were working on. You were just scared to death because Rick had yelled at you.
Oh, that's funny. Well, the thing is like, when you're a kid and you have family that comes in like that, you're excited to see your family that's in town. You don't want to go to bed. You want to be up and spend time with them because, you know, you don't get to see them that often.
That's right. So
I probably saw you and had to go to the bathroom.
Yeah, that happened every time I showed up within 5 minutes.
Oh, it's Tommy. Oh, I got to go poop.
Your mother would say, he hadn't gone in 2 weeks. I'm glad you showed up.
Oh, now that I'm thoroughly embarrassed.
Yeah. Well, you almost saw Santa Claus one time, didn't you?
Yeah, that's right. I can remember coming downstairs and there was a Santa Claus that was in our kitchen. I wasn't really sure. And I thought it was you, but I wasn't really sure. Well, I still don't know to this day.
Well, that's because nobody's ever confessed.
Is anybody going to confess today?
I plead the fifth.
I didn't think so. Well, I hope you guys enjoyed this episode of Tommy's train stories and Mike's lawyer stories and a couple Christmas stories smothered in.
Yeah, there's no legal briefs. There might be railroad briefs.
Yeah. If you ever do derail a train and you're in need of something, just remember you can use a refrigerator door in case of emergency.
Yeah, there you go. And anytime you read a bit in the paper about some derailment that happened anywhere near you, they say it's still under investigation. I have, in my experience, that within 30 minutes of showing up, pretty much they know what happened. They just don't want to tell anybody.
Yeah, they're waiting for it to die down a little bit.
Oh, yeah.
It's not ripe to tell the story just yet.
That's right.
So we are actually going to, I know this episode's a little bit late this week, but we are actually going to take next week off.
Yeah, we were going to take this week off, but we got changed by our sponsor.
That's right.
Say one of the episode out this week.
That's right.
So here it is. It's out. We're telling everybody Merry Christmas because we won't talk to you again until after Christmas.
That's
so we hope you all have a good Christmas.
And I'll be by the time our next episode comes out, I'll be a year older. Well, no, not quite.
No, not yet.
Not yet.
No, it will be on your birthday, probably.
Well,
comes out on Monday the 31st.
Oh, that's my birthday.
Yeah.
We'll have a birthday episode.
That's right. We'll have a birthday episode.
Happy birthday to me.
And we're going
to
be at Candle Nights here in a couple nights.
That's right. Candle Nights coming up.
Yep.
Excited for that. Candle Nights is the most wonderful time of year.
At least around here.
It is. All right. Well, Merry Christmas, everybody, and I hope you have a wonderful holiday and have some time with your family and maybe some time off work.
That's right. And Merry Christmas to you, little buddy.
Thanks, Tommy. Merry Christmas to you, too.
Well, all right. Well, amble on up and try to close your eyes, even though you're excited, so we can get set up for Santa Claus.
I gotta go play soccer tonight. I don't know what you're talking about. I got a game in Hurricane tonight. Indoor soccer.
Well, all right. Well, have fun. Some of us will be less ambitious than that. I'm done in from jumping off of trains.
Thanks to everybody for listening, and thanks to MCRB for use of their song, Doctor, Lawyer, Indian Chief.
And thanks to the McElroy Stable of Podcasts for the use of their recording studio. Their podcasts include Mabim Bam, Sawbones, and Still Buffering, as well as many other fine offerings. And please, take the time to rate and review us on iTunes, especially if you liked us. If you didn't, well, then not so much.
You're not supposed to say that.
You always edit that out, though, right?
Usually.
Good.
This has been Court Appointed. I'm Mike Meadows, your co-host. I'm a lawyer and a dude.
And I'm your other co-host, Tommy Smurf. And I'm just a dude.